Hello and welcome to this, the concluding part of a two-part interview with Carol Gilligan, which is part of a series from Polity. I began this second part by asking how her fellow academics had responded to the challenge she presented in 1982, when she published her landmark study, In a Different Voice.
You know, it was like a two-step. The first response was, oh, well, you know, this rings true to what I saw or what I experienced. And I, Laurie Kohlberg said, I explains my data that interviews responses of women that, or girls that I couldn't make sense of. And Eric Erickson was very interested. And I'd also taught with him. At the time, there was a kind of mea culpa from psychologists. I was invited, you know, to present at Yale and Harvard, all over. And there would be this sort of like rising up, and people would say, you know, I realize now that when I reported my data and it was published, I didn't mention that I, you know, didn't report my data on women because I couldn't make sense out of it. And I don't think I said that in the article, you know, because of course, for psychologists to leave out women, that's half the sample, so it's a rather glaring omission. So there was that, and that is like this rings true to experience. And yeah, I can hear that, or a Boston Globe reporter stopped me on the street and he said, you know, you explained my marriage. Somebody else said, you explained my divorce, you know. So that was great for me that people heard what I heard. And then the two-step. I remember it was a conference that Eric Erickson was at, and his wife is like, but you don't expect me to change my theory just because women don't fit. And it was, well, actually I do. And it's not just women. It's, if you listen for this different voice, you will hear it in men too. So it does mean changing your theory. And that's where the argument was engaged. And I think, oddly enough, because what is it, almost 30 years now? I think that's where the argument is right now. And I think it's not a question of women. I think what people heard as a woman's voice, that is a voice that joined reason and emotion and was therefore called irrational, or that joined self and relationship and therefore was described as not having clear boundaries, or that disjoined mind and body and therefore was seen as sort of new agey or God knows what, it was described as a woman's voice, is now recognized by a whole series of scientists across the human sciences as a human voice. So in my current book, the question becomes, which is, it's a thrilling moment for me, how do we lose our humanity? And why don't we resist that loss? And that's what I'm writing about now.
Yeah, I mean, it's as you say, a compelling amount of evidence across a wide range of scientific disciplines in the last 30 years have enabled us to get beyond this sort of sterile, essentialist counterposing of, quotes, masculine and feminine characteristics, hasn't it? As you say, and cut through that to something which is about our humanity rather than our gender.
Exactly. And we can see how in the name of gender, and gender is a hugely powerful psychological lever because it's so connected to shaming. You know, to say to a man, well, you don't strike me as a real man, or to say to a woman of, well, you know, you may be brilliant or this, but you don't strike me as very feminine. Tell me, do you have a relationship? You know, do you know, I mean, you can, and it goes directly to how you feel about your body and your desires and how your identity. So if you want to initiate people into splitting themselves off from parts of their humanity in order to set up, I don't know, you could say whether you want to say a competitive capitalist system or an educational system that's constantly involved in ranking everybody so that, you know, or a patriarchal system where, you know, the people who rise to the top are a sort of certain group of fathers. And you do this around gender, it's very powerful psychologically. That's what I saw. I mean, I don't think it's conscious. I don't think a committee met one Monday morning and figured this out. but I think it's what goes on. And so if you look at the times in growing up, when children who don't conform to gender scripts get really badly shamed or beaten up or excluded, boys at the beginning of primary school, where they get called gay or like a girl if they don't act like a boy. I have little grandsons now, and you can sort of see this. Or girls when they reach adolescence, and there's the division between good and bad girls. You know, we know who they are. And suddenly you see this sudden kind of, I don't want to say blooming, because it's not, that's too positive an image, but of psychological symptoms. The boys suddenly have all these learning and speech and attention problems, and they get depressed and everything, and the girls, adolescents, have eating disorders and everything else. You start to say, this is the psyche resisting an initiation that's going to, you know, separate people from parts, vital parts of themselves, so they will lose their capacity to navigate the human world accurately or effectively, and become prey to false authority. I mean, it becomes politically very, very dangerous. You know, you can undermine democracy, because if we don't have access to our experience, then we can't judge authority against, does this correspond with what I know on the basis of experience?
I mean, you use a very powerful metaphor that I wrote down. I was so sort of struck by it. You say this process whereby society mandates dissociation is like a stake being driven through the heart of the psyche, which is a very, I mean, it's a very, very arresting and a strong claim.
But I think it's a very precise description. I mean, the minute you admit split consciousness, which in fact is something we all know about and has been written about, I mean, whether it's Du Bois writing about the souls of black folks and double consciousness, whether does he call it the strange but peculiar sensation of double consciousness, or you go to Freud, studies on hysteria, and he talks about split consciousness, or you go and read Shakespeare, or you go and read, we know that our consciousness can become divided. That's what self-deception is all about and everything else. And I thought, that's exactly it. That's the moment where a stake is driven. And it was really amazing to me, because it showed up so specifically, so literally. I interviewed girls, starting with, you know, 6-7 year olds and going through to 17 year olds, and would interview the same girl year after year for 5 years. And as this initiation process began, suddenly the phrase, I don't know, would come into the interviews. And let's say at 11, it occurs 20 times. And then at 12, it's occurring 60 times. And at 13, it's in 120. I'm just making up these numbers, but that was it. You could do a statistical analysis. I mean, you could count. And I thought, look what's happening. The injunction don't is coming right between I and no, because I found that if I placed my tent as a researcher right there and started to question that, the phrase, I don't know, was a cover for what the girl knew but felt she was not supposed to know. For example, I'll give you an example, that very sort of simple example. It comes from a four-year-old boy, actually, who says to his mother, Mommy, why are you sad? And she says, I'm not sad. And he says to her, Mommy, I know you. I was inside you. So he knows she's sad. And then she says, I'm not sad. And if he says, oh, I must have been wrong. I thought you were sad. And she says, no, no, I'm happy. You see what I'm saying? He starts to not know what he knew, because what is he going to say to her? You are? It's a very delicate negotiation when you know something about someone that they may say is not going on, or when, and I'm with my girls, I mean, an 11-year-old says to her mother, I'm angry at you because when you and daddy argue, you always give in. And the mother says, I was so humiliated, I was so ashamed that she noticed that. So there's going to be pressure. Either the mother has to know that and start to think about why does she do that, and feel her embarrassment that her daughter is seeing this. What is she teaching her daughter? Or she has to pressure her daughter not to know it. It looks like I'm giving in, but really, you know. That was the process I caught.
And I was fascinated among these adolescent girls how there would be a sort of doubling whereby they would, in one instance, be expressing what they really felt.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be another version, and this might be in a school essay, for example. There's a lot of cases where a girl wants to write a particular essay, but she knows that it's not acceptable to her teacher. Therefore, she writes the one she wants, and she also writes one which is in more in conformity. And this kind of pattern of doubling of what their true self wants to express versus what they feel obliged to express by society is one that seemed to me recurred, especially in contact with formal education.
Exactly. And when I ran a workshop one weekend at Harvard for student leaders, and I talked about the fact that these girls at 11 were writing two papers, the one they wanted, the one that would get the A and the one they wanted to write, which really is a brilliant way of holding on to, you know. And all these student leaders at Harvard said that was their experience. Except that what they didn't do is they didn't write the second paper. And then with students, what I hear all the time is, you know, well, I have to write the one that gets the A now, but when I graduate, I'll write the one I want to write. And then when I get my PhD, I write the one I want to write. Or when I get tenure, when I die, you know.
Well, there's a very sad case of a girl in the book who says, well, you know, maybe I'll just have to go and live in Montana and keep chickens. And you don't feel that she's saying that because that's really what her heart desires, but that's because that's the option that she feels is available to her because she is unable to sort of break through and express what she wants to express in society.
Well, I always think of Virginia Woolf and saying to women, you know, when you have to get inside because you have to know what the conversation is, but stay outside. And I think that sense of how to be inside and keep your outsider's view, and this is not just for women, it's for any group that has been outside. At that moment of entry, you're in a very creative space. And I think this 17-year-old who talks about, I'll go live in a chicken farm in Montana. And I can relate to her about that sense of, if I went very far away so these other voices aren't too loud, then I could stay with the voice in my head, which is often a quieter voice, and actually write it out. And then this now, as someone who teaches in the university, I think, how can I create a space in the university that's resonant with that voice? And that's my listening class.
I thought it was fascinating when you were talking about the relationship between adolescent girls and their educators, their teachers, who are often predominantly female. Perhaps you can describe what happened at a seminar you were running for teachers about how to encourage girls to give voice openly to their true sort of thoughts and feelings.
Sure. But also, I want to say the same thing happened in the group I ran for fathers of four-year-old boys. When you trace the psychological history and you see it happening in real time, boys turning from 4 to 5 to 6, or girls turning from 11 to 12 to 13, or then, as my colleague does with boys from, let's say, 14 to 18, you see these changes happening. And then you realize that as adults, we carry that history within us. So if you bring adults into the presence of children, particularly at that ages, it's going to be, you know, it's like Proust with his Madeleine, that the voice of the child is going to begin to resonate with things that may be buried in the adult, experiences that they know but they may have forgotten, and begin to open a storehouse of recollections. So this did happen with the fathers of young boys at 4 and 5. But when we did this workshop for the teachers, it was because I had said that we did an initial thing in the school for girls, and where I discovered the girls were voting for an honor code they didn't believe in. So I was asked to come and speak to the teachers. So I said to them, if you're educating girls to be citizens in a democratic society, I think it's important for them to learn how to voice their disagreement openly rather than vote for something that they have, A, don't believe in, and B, have no intention of obeying. And one of the teachers says, how can we teach girls to disagree openly when we can't disagree openly ourselves? And I thought, that's a good question. You know, you can't, basically. So then the teacher said, we want to go on retreat with you. So I thought, great. So we started these women teaching girls, girls teaching women retreats. And, the, you know, the moment that was the most dramatic moment was this sixth, seventh grade teacher saying, what happens to girls when they get this to this age and they begin to lose touch with what they know? And then she says, because that's the age when they identify with women. And then she says, ugh. And she suddenly sees what she's saying, which is for girls to identify with women, they're looking for a woman and they're finding she's not there. She's not accessible. So it raised a huge question for women, for mothers, for teachers, for women therapists, which is how to be present with girls at the point where girls are entering womanhood. And I think we as women really have internalized almost a taboo about passing along certain things that we know from experience to the next generation of women. And certainly the accusations of doing so. I mean, you're called shrill, harsh. What are you, a feminist? What are you, you know? For example, what women know about living with men, what we know, women who live intimately with men, what we know about intimate relationships with men, including the struggles of men, the vulnerabilities of men, what we know about marriage, you know, what we know as women working in workplaces that are still largely, all of the adaptive strategies that we've derived, there is almost a taboo about passing these along. And so we either pass along a kind of fantasy version or idealized version or even a demonized version. I mean, you know, all men are monsters and all they want is sex. Do you know what I'm saying? Which is absurd. I mean, it's just, it's grotesque. But that's what girls are looking for.
And what I mean, this is maybe a big question, but why do you think that taboo is so difficult to shift?
Well, you know, you are that goes right back to In a Different Voice, which is you bring women's voices. And that, by which I mean a voice, the voice of what a woman really knows from her own experience, what she really feels and thinks, not how necessarily she's been taught to think, because we've all been taught to think in the way that so-called people think, people meaning, you know, privileged men or something like that. You bring women's voices into the conversation, it shifts the conversation. And the conversation that has been called the human conversation has gone on for centuries, for millennia, in part because women have not been part of it. And certain parts of human experience, including a lot of things that men know, are not spoken aloud. And women are, you know, let in part under the agreement not to say certain things. The current big secret is, guess what, men are humans. I mean, it's very funny, except my work began with the statement, guess what, women are humans, and you can't study humans and leave out women. So, you know, we're all humans, meaning we're basically beings who are capable of empathy, of what Sarah Hurdy, the anthropologist, calls mind reading, which is we pick up the thoughts and feelings of other people. Neurologists will speak of mirror neurons, and it used to be called women's intuition. It's called, you know, that's what humans can do, and we're hardwired for cooperation. So that's who we are as humans. So we know a lot about each other. Yeah. I think to my psychology students, there is no instrument that is as sensitive as a human being.
I mean, I thought your characterization of feminism as the project to free democracy from patriarchy was a very useful one, a very thought-provoking one, and a very inclusive one, and therefore one which, you know, is enabling not just for women, but also potentially for men.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you think what... And I really honestly didn't see this so clearly until last year, year before. Patriarchy, almost by definition, is based on a gender binary. I mean, it means man equals not woman, because you have to have patriarchs, just men, in positions of authority, and a gender hierarchy, that whatever is gendered masculine is elevated over whatever is gendered feminine. I mean, by definition, it's antagonistic to democracy. And it's also against human nature, you know. So basically, yeah, I think feminism is one of the great historic liberation movements. It's the movement to free democracy from patriarchy, and it's in everybody's interest, because patriarchy deforms both women and men. And, oh, that's what women know about men. And it's hard for men to say, because men are seen to benefit from patriarchy. And women who love men and who live closely with men, and I include mothers of sons and sisters of brothers, you know how men have to struggle, where whole parts of themselves, I mean, feelings, their feelings of sadness, their knowledge that they're vulnerable, which they are, we're all vulnerable, are seen as unmasculine. So you know that.
And even if those things are not innate, but culturally determined, they are still pretty ingrained, aren't they? So shifting both genders out of those stereotypes is still a big deal, even if they're not determined by biology.
Yeah, I think they are clearly not biologically determined, because the biology says, no, we're all, you know, we're empathic, we're hardwired for cooperation, we are relational creatures, we're born with a voice, into relationships, so forth. So they're determined by culture, but that's why I found myself writing about initiation and driving a stake through the psyche. It's an initiation that goes very, very deep, because it says you pull the stake out and your masculinity will be on the line, you will be called a bad woman. And this is very powerful. We don't think that still goes on, but, you know, are you kidding?
You know? I mean, I think you write somewhere in the book about even senior university professors are not immune to this. You know, highly intelligent people are not immune to the kind of gender roles and falling into certain patterns of behavior, because they feel those are the only ones which are available to them without losing, you know, that essential masculinity in this case.
Yeah, I mean, you say to a man, what kind of a man are you? And he's on the defensive. You know, what man would say that? Boys don't cry. I mean, just to take a simple thing. Anyway, what's amazing, I guess, to me is all these years of research and the cumulatively beginning to see how something happens. And if you understand how it happens, you can begin to think about, A, first of all, it doesn't have to happen, and how it could not happen, and the freedom that would open. As in just this small experiment, my listening class, one term, you know, small group of students, just a class, 2 hours a week. And that really has caught my imagination, my optimism. This doesn't have to happen. And it doesn't benefit men. It doesn't benefit women. And given where we are as a species, you know, with the planet in danger with nuclear weapons, we've really got to figure this out now. And also then to understand it's not some superficial thing that somebody just says, here's a gender script, follow it. It's tied to very, very powerful feelings. So if you're going to change this, you really have to think very seriously about how you're going to deal with the issues of shaming that will come up in the process, or how you'll deal with the pushback, which is just inevitable. I mean, one way to deny this is to say, patriarchy, oh, that's so archaic, it's nowhere around us anymore, it's ridiculous to talk about this now. Feminism, that means men hating lesbians, I don't know what that is. Okay, you can get rid of all that language, but, you know, you have to look at what's really going on, and it's one of the reasons this research with on development with children is you see it happening, and you're around 5 and 6, any or certain boys who are in touch with their human nature are called girls or gay until they sort of separate themselves from large parts of themselves. Anyway, you see it going on.
So, I mean, do you think things have changed for the better since 1982?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, come on. You know, when I first was in the university, there were no women on the senior faculty practically. And I think we're in the midst of a huge period of social change. I think, you know, if you want to look back historically, it's probably a comparable period would be the Reformation. With the Reformation, it was like complete reevaluation of all the assumptions about authority and sort of, you know, and if you think of men's and women's lives, I mean, family life, work life, in the past, what, 30, 40 years, it's changed so dramatically, the workplace, families. And I think the outcome is what's now, what's at stake.
I mean, you say towards the end of the book, Carol, that you're optimistic but not naive. And I wondered what you thought the agenda was for the sort of immediate future, not looking 10 or 20 years ahead, but, you know, what do you think really is the work that we have to be focusing on in the next few years?
You know, in a sense, it's a psychologist's question, which is why we're acting so self-destructively. I mean, or why we're playing ostrich and putting our heads in the sand and really not looking at the implications of the choices we're making, as if we didn't know what, in fact, we know. I wrote my book in part to say, look, I think if you don't pick up the lens of gender, if you don't see how these things are gendered and therefore moves that are really showing a way out of this get sabotaged by calling it unmasculine or something like that. Or when masculinity is in question, violence is imminent. And so if we can understand this dynamic, we can really move through it. And I think it's right in front of us now. I think one way to put it, I don't care if you like these terms or not, but I mean, it's like, here's the end game between democracy and patriarchy. You can see it in the Arab Spring. I mean, all these movements, which showed that, contrary to what a lot of experts said, in fact, people who are Arabs, like other human beings, desire to have a voice and really move toward freedom. Everybody said that was a Western concept. Well, it happens to be a human desire. And there were a lot of women involved, certainly in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, who were involved in those things. And then you thought, what was the pushback? You know, it was from a certain kind of patriarchal thing that suddenly the women were disappearing. And suddenly, instead of the desire to have a voice and have freedom, there was a kind of new top-down ideology coming down. So I think that's alive. I think it's alive all over the globe right now. And kind of basic things, knowing what you know, even if you'd rather not know it, which is that climate change has real consequences. They're going to be very, very potentially catastrophic. And nuclear weapons, all that kind of thing. What I think is so encouraging, in some ways, it's like, you know, the belief that the earth heals itself. What comes along at this moment in the human sciences is this fundamental paradigm shift saying, well, we were wrong. As humans, we're not basically aggressive and competitive creatures. We are hardwired for empathy and cooperation. And what distinguishes us from our great ape ancestors, this is Sarah Hurdy, is our capacity for mutual understanding. And you think, and that could save us. So then you have to say, what gets in the way? And, you know, you certainly want to talk about economics and capitalism and competitive systems, and you want to talk about the educational system and how it can stifle curiosity and set up a kind of zero-sum game where one person wins at the expense of another person losing and what that sets up psychologically. And you want to talk about gender and how it kind of comes in places is, you know, a kind of fork in the psyche and says, you know, men on this side, women on this side. So we have the knowledge we're gaining the knowledge to find our way out of the predicament that in part these old systems have led us into, which makes it a moment of tremendous optimism. But I think it's totally naive to think, and so off we go into the sunset. I mean, no, there's going to be huge pushback, not only from those forces that are invested in patriarchy, I mean, in Sharia law and all this kind of thing, or Orthodox, any religion, which is Orthodox. Fundamentalism means fundamentally patriarchal. I mean, you can just translate it. But that within ourselves, we've internalized these systems. So we've got to be psychologically smart. And that's what I write a chapter in my book on psychoanalysis, which, like feminism and patriarchy, has been put on the sort of rubbish pile, and saying maybe we should take it out and look at it because it holds the potential for liberation, because it shows you that the way out of dissociation is through association. And we're back to the artist.
Carol Gilligan. Joining the Resistance is out now in hardback. You can find out more about it by visiting the Polity website at politybooks.com. Until next time, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.